Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, RN's weekly flutter in the pop culture stakes.
And I'm Jason DeRosso, and today, is it time for Australian movies to give up the idea of a cinema-first release and head online?
And when fashion on the field becomes racetrack roadkill. We saw a lot of snide commentary this week about the trashiness of trackside fashion, but one voice rose to the defence of the fascinator and the true spirit of carnival. Well, this week we saw the multi-billion dollar float of Twitter, the seven-year-old company that's never made a profit, but is quite a lot of fun if you're into gossip, unreliable news and videos of sleeping teen idols.
Yes, Justin Bieber's colourful tour of South America is rolling on despite the sordid rumours and pictures. And a couple of days ago, that short video which emerged of the 19-year-old sleeping next to his baseball cap, apparently posted by a Brazilian woman who we see in the video blowing him a kiss. She's since been identified as the winner of a 2012 bikini pageant.
God help him. Yes, but closer to home, and in fact on our sunny shores this week, also we saw the launch of the Ten Network's much-vaunted breakfast beach party, Wake Up.
We're doing things differently in the mornings, and I am so excited because we are going to talk about everything. Absolutely everything.
All that and so much more right here from beautiful Manly Beach.
Yeah, the promo makes it sound like the most amazing clam bake ever, but the skies were a little overcast by the end of the week with very low ratings and, of course, the departure of the show's executive producer, Adam Boland, who's taken indefinite sick leave.
Look, I think it's a really bold concept and, you know, teething problems are to be expected and you've got to give a bit of credit to Channel 10 because it's backed the project through thick and thin and whether you like it or not, it's trying to do something really different in news and current affairs and good on them.
Well, one thing I do like about it is that it's getting away from that daggy dad and tutting mum kind of good cop, bad cop model of breakfast TV on the other stations. So yeah. We'll see how it goes, though.
Yeah, good luck to them. But the theme of this week really was the peak of the spring racing carnival.
Bold and bright was the story of the cup fashions, made even better by the brilliant weather. The public lawns became the catwalk as the fashion stakes competed against the racing and the roses.
Months of planning, preparation and a small fortune goes into creating some of the spectacular cup day outfits.
I spent the last 120 hours sequining and beading my outfit.
I definitely still do stilettos, but I do the more comfy ones.
The shoes are unwalkable.
Yeah, well, Spring Racing Carnival certainly is a fashion landmark in Australia, but sometimes for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately.
Yes, it seems to bring out the brightest in people, doesn't it? One commentator this week called it the Festival of the Bogan.
Well, there is a bit of snide commentary around, especially the general admission section at the big races like the Melbourne Cup, isn't there? Women, young women wearing dresses that are too short, men in ill-fitting suits. But is this unfair and are we missing the point about Spring Carnival as a fashion event? Well, Mel Campbell rose to the defence of this fashion spectacle. She's a fashion writer and cultural critic. She joins us now. G'day, Mel. Welcome to The List.
Hi, Mel.
Hello.
So is it true, do you think we're missing the point when we're making all these snide remarks about people with their stilettos over their shoulder after one of the big races in the Spring Carnival?
Yeah, I think that what really strikes me about these kinds of descriptions is the lack of empathy, the sort of real sense of judgment and a boundary setting that come with a lot of these descriptions. So it's about delineating us and them. So them are obviously these abject people who don't know how to dress, who don't know how to behave in what is meant to be a quote-unquote civilised way. But we, on the other hand, are able to identify what's right. And so it's about judging other people. And that's, I think, why the word bogan is so often mentioned, because bogan is a term that in Australia works to set up those kinds of cultural barriers between us and them.
Well, this is actually the title of your master's thesis, Bogan, Exploring Images of Australian Cultural Marginalisation. What is it about the use of the word bogan in the context of the Spring Racing Carnival that you
Well, look, it's a really slippery term because basically bogan means whatever we don't want to be at any one particular point in time. So it can morph around being a consumer project, you know, things that people consume in a vulgar kind of way. It's also a class thing. It's about people who do the wrong things, bring up their families in quote-unquote the wrong ways. But when we look at racing, it's basically about people who are trying to sort of aim for some kind of higher class behaviour and dress, but we perceive that they're falling short. So we see them as being sort of over-ambitious. We hear the term aspirational a lot in Australia, and aspirational seems to have a weird slippage with bogan in a lot of these cultural debates that we have. And so here we see people who just want to get dressed up, want to have a fun day out with their friends and family at the races, and then they get squished back into the little boxes that we want to put them in, which I think is such a shame, because what we're seeing is a spring racing carnival. I want to put the emphasis on the carnival here, because it's about having fun, and it's about feeling like it's a special day, a day that's not like other days, that you wear clothes that, let's face it, there's really not that much other opportunity to wear these kinds of clothes in everyday life.
So it's a bit like hearkening back to older forms of carnival and festival where roles of master and servant, for example, are reversed.
Yeah, exactly. So carnival was first talked about by Mikhail Bakhtin, who was a folklore specialist, a Russian folklore specialist, and he looked at the ways that in folklore there were moments where the traditions were upended, masters became servants and vice versa. Sexual mores were different and sort of temporarily abandoned. So morality didn't apply, but it was always a very limited time, you know, one carnival day or a weekend or a week or something. And then after that, we had expunged all our sort of base animalistic desires and we would go back to the way things ordinarily were. But it's a way that we explore and play. It's a playful kind of thing, carnival.
But do you think some of what people kind of don't like about these masses of people sort of dressing up in this way and behaving in this way is that it's not actually done in a spirit of kind of irreverence necessarily or with any sort of radical intent.
It is just unintentional
this,
burlesque.
Well, it is this kind of aspirational of the worst kind, because it's this kind of unthinking mimicry of celebrity culture, perhaps.
See, I don't have a problem with the fact that people might not be aware that that's what they're trying to do. Although it's fascinating, don't you think, that racing is called the sport of kings? Mm. And it's got so many establishment connotations. When you think that pretty much the only other people that we see wearing those kinds of hats are members of the royal family, you know, there is a real class thing. But that's why it's so fascinating that we don't really focus on the members. We don't focus on the people in the birdcage or in the members' car park or in those corporate marquees. We don't criticise their behaviour. It's only the hoi polloi, the general admission people. And so I think that there is a class dimension, but I'm not going to ridicule people or criticise them simply for wanting to dress up and to be, you know, I hate this word, but classy. Because it's one of those words, don't you think, that connotes its absolute opposite. As soon as you say classy, you mean, no, not classy at all. But here, classy is really important, because a race meeting is a performance of class in a way. And a lot of the things that people do, eating the chicken sandwiches and the smoked salmon, drinking the champagne, all those sorts of things are traditionally associated with richness, you know, being wealthy, even betting, being able to flash your money around and spend it on things that might be considered unnecessary or even wasteful. I mean, that's a performance of wealth too. I mean, and I think we're almost treading on very dangerous ideological ground when we say that people aren't allowed to do those sorts of things. I think that instead we should recognise that there's a playfulness and a joy to be had in those things that we're kind of crushing when we criticise people.
Well, it turns out that the true sport of Spring Carnival isn't on the track at all. It's in the people watching the people watching the people.
Absolutely. I love watching the newspaper and online photo galleries where they've sent their photographers out. I'm not on Instagram, but if I were, I would be going to Instagram as well and looking at people's photos that they take of themselves and each other, because that tells you so much about how people see themselves and the way that they interpret the world is through images. I mean, in my book, Out of Shape, I'm very critical about the way that our culture is mediated so much through images. And I say that that's the reason why we tend to feel so bad about our bodies, is because we look at each other and we imagine ourselves being the object of critical stares. But what I do love is seeing people who've just really nailed it and look really happy. So those are the images that I'm drawn to.
Mm, there's one actually on your blog, and it really turned my mind. You changed the way I felt about this issue, because you have a picture of this gorgeous young girl blonde plaited hair, pink dress, pink flowers in her hair, and she's sitting next to some yellow roses, and you say, look at this doll. Doesn't she look young and gorgeous?
Well, and she did. That was that was the first photo that I saw, and just the wonderful spring colours, the bright colours. It's festive. If we want to get back to that idea of festivity and carnival, these people aren't wearing sort of dreary, dark colours that Melbourne is, you know, always traditionally known and obviously lampooned for, basically. Spring Racing Carnival is a time when people feel free to dress in really colourful clothes, which I love. You know, from the jockeys wearing the colourful silks to the roses that are so beautifully groomed at this time of year, and to the effort that everyone puts in. That's the other thing that I love, you know, seeing people matching their accessories and putting so much thought into their hair and their fascinators or hats or flowers that they're wearing in their hair. I find ordinary people's clothes at the races so much better to look at and more fascinating and more revealing of them as people than I do of the styled people that you see in the marquees.
Well, Mel Campbell, your enthusiasm for Spring Racing Carnival is certainly infectious. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us on the list.
Yeah, thanks.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Mel Campbell is a freelance journalist and cultural critic. She is the founding editor of online pop culture magazine The Enthusiast, and her debut book, Out of Shape, Debunking Myths About Fashion and Fit, is out now.
And we will put a link to her blog and you can have a look at that gorgeous young doll for yourself. On RN, this is The List. I'm Cassie McCullough, and with me is co-host Jason DeRosso. And now to Australian film. Can you recognise this film?
We got some freshies, Linz. You've always said if the stars were maligned, we should just go through with it.
What are you doing?
Sorry.
We need you to remain calm, miss. You're on 100 bloody acres.
Don't you dare hurt her, you psycho!
We're not psychos, all right?
We're small business operators.
Well, it contained a hint. That was actually a clip from the trailer of the Australian comedy horror film 100 Bloody Acres, which released earlier in the year in the winter. And if you didn't recognise that film, well, you can be forgiven because it was only released on 6 screens. But this week, a statistic emerged which has shown how popular it's been amongst online pirators. It is in the top 100 of the most pirated films internationally. Now, this gets to the crux of the discussion we're about to have on Australian films and their struggle to reach an audience. Australian films only occupy about 5% of total box office, and traditionally this fact has attracted claims that Australian films just aren't good enough. But increasingly, focus is turning to the issue of how we distribute our films. Well, joining us now is Lauren Carroll Harris, a film scholar and author of the latest quarterly platform paper published by Currency House titled Not at a Cinema Near You, Australia's Film Distribution Problem, and Gary Maddox, longtime film writer for the Sydney Morning Herald. Hello, Lauren. Hello, Gary.
Hey there.
Hello, Jase. Hi, both of you.
Now, Lauren, first to you. You argue that Australian films are being let down by an old-fashioned system built on long-held agreements. You argue that going for digital distribution could be part of the solution. But what do you see as the problem? Describe it in your words.
Well, absolutely. I don't think the problem is the stories that we're telling, and 100 Bloody Acres is a great example of that. The New York Times critic Matt Zoller-Seitz said that he thought that 100 Bloody Acres was the best horror comedy since Shaun of the Dead. So that's a pretty strong endorsement. But, you know, a release strategy that sees it open on 6 arthouse screens actually ensures that not only will it be a flop at the box office, but it'll be a success on pirate networks.
So the fact that it's only released on 6 screens means it presumably has a very low box office. Does that damage its reputation?
Well, it made essentially nothing, given it cost $2.3 million to make and it took around $10,000 at the box office. That's essentially nothing. And sometimes I think that poor performance at the box office can actually really unfairly give Australian films a bad name and damage them down the track. But it seems that actually 100 Bloody Acres has found an audience, not at the cinema, but online.
Now, the problem is, of course, that there is this window that that is, I think, legislated, right, between the date that a film can release in a cinema and the date that the filmmakers can then release that movie on DVD or online. Describe to me this situation and how long is this window?
The way that it works is that it's a hangover from the 20th century, basically, when film was on film and it could be contained. When a film would open at the theatres and then, you know, 3 or 4 months down the line, or, you know, at an indeterminate amount of time down the line, it'd open on VHS or now DVD and on digital, on video on demand. The problem with that is you can't control digital files. Once a film is out there now, it's going to be on pirate networks. And so I guess the new model is give audiences what they want, when they want, and that's how you take a bite out of piracy. And there are filmmakers who are experimenting with how to do that, with how to monetize piracy. And that's, I think, really interesting thing to do.
Gary?
Yeah. Well, in the case of 100 Bloody Acres, I think that reflects a few things, one of which is that there's not really a market for horror films in Australia as there is in the States. The college circuit that, you know, gets fed constantly by low-budget horror films, most of them apparently made by James Wan, which... then kind of, you know, succeed in their own rights, have a little niche within the market. We don't have that here, and except for something like Wolf Creek, Australian horror films have really struggled. The fact that 100 Bloody Acres got a release maybe a year after it was made, very small release, something like 1 or 2 screens in Sydney, sort of suggests that it had done the rounds, it had been turned down by other distributors who didn't see it as having, you know, a commercial film, and they'd pretty much put it out to set up the DVD release. That's kind of, you know, seems to be the kind of model that it was. I agree with you. The piracy does demonstrate that there is an audience for it. It's probably an international audience, and it's probably an audience who are not prepared to pay $19 to see it in the cinema. They're more likely to be watching, you know, things that they've downloaded. But Australian films generally, this year we've seen the big success this year is The Great Gatsby, of course, Hollywood-backed production, as big as any of the big, you know, American summer blockbusters. It opened in Australia on 587 screens, which is a pretty huge release. Iron Man 3, 631 screens, Thor, the latest Thor, 609 screens. Films of that sort of scale are not only just in every multiplex, which means they're very accessible to everybody who wants to go and see a movie, but it also means probably that they're taking up a number of cinemas within those multiplexes and also a huge number of time slots. Not many Australian films get a release as wide as that, of course, but we have had a few of them that have had more than 100 screens this year, which 100 screens of the 2,000 in the country is a pretty decent sort of spread around
there.
So
what would they be?
Drift, 140 screens. Return to Nim's Island, Goddess, went out in 207 screens. That was the Ronan Keating and Magda Sabansky musical. Save Your Legs, the cricket comedy, 176 screens. Drift, of course, was a surfing film. None of them really worked. None of them really caught people's attentions. None of them caught a light. None of them were really what you'd call a box office success. But then you have a whole batch of more traditional art house films that do get much smaller releases.
So it's just, yeah, it's not making it easy for people. But Lauren, if you're thinking of something like Save Your Legs, which was a cricket kind of drama comedy, Brendan Cowell was in it, right. Australians love their cricket, you'd think, and it got a decent sort of release. What was wrong there? And do you think that, say, releasing it online at the same time as releasing it in bricks and mortar theatres would have, you know, given it a better life?
It was a decent release, but it was quite an unthinking release, I thought. I think the way that if you're going to intervene into that cinema market, which, as Gary said, is very squeezed for screens, is full up with Hollywood product that's very, like, hyper-marketed, you have to really think how you're going to do that. And the films this year in Australia that have succeeded in doing that have been, like, The Turning, I think, by Robert Connolly, which have taken... like put their own stamp on the bricks and mortar release and made a big deal of it, made event style kind of nights out. Like they haven't just sold tickets to the movies. They've sold a ticket to an evening where you see a Q&A with the cast and crew and things like that. And that's what Save Your Legs really didn't do. They just kind of rolled out a fairly straightforward, you know, automatic cookie cutter release. And I think more and more we're seeing that Hollywood formula of rolling out a standard theatrical release is just not working for Australian films.
Yeah, you bring up the turning and obviously, you know, it's a fantastic concept and the idea of an interval and so many directors and it's very successful critically. But what did it earn? And how many people worked on it? How many did everyone end up with about $5 at the end? I mean, why are we making films as a kind of artistic expression when it's actually an industry? Why don't we treat it like an industry?
It's an artistic medium and it's an industry. And, you know, the Turning has taken more than a million right now, which I think is significant given its release strategy and given the kind of movie it is. It is quite challenging. It's more than 3 hours. But, you know, I think there's a cultural argument. You know, I think what these films contribute is unquantifiable. And I think there are a lot of films that are being let down by their release strategies. There are good films being failed by the current cinema system. But what The Turning is doing is setting itself up for a DVD release, I think, and they're doing that quite well.
And they've also got pre-sale with television as well.
That's right.
So.
Yeah. Just put that in context. The Turning's out in 25 cinemas, 25 of the 2,000 cinemas in Australia. So, again, it's a very art house release, geographically specific, also specific in terms of the times you can actually see it. There are films this year, RIPD, the action comedy with Ryan Reynolds and Jeff Bridges that people may be forgiven for not seeing. Movie 43.
I missed that one.
The comedy, again, another film that people be forgiven for not seeing. RIPD was out on 254 screens, Movie 43, 145 screens. Both of those films were demonstrated failures on US. If they had been Cars released to the market, they wouldn't have been able to be released in Australia because they would have failed in their own market. Yet they had bigger releases than every other Australian film except for Gatsby this year.
But that's because they're such potent players in, even as failures, they're such potent commodities, aren't they, in the marketplace. It's partly the marketing, but it's also just the allure of, you know, the great spectacle of an American film, even when it is a bit of a flop.
Yeah, I think there's a point to that because it kind of disproves this idea that the reason Australian films don't do better at the box office is because they're crap and they're boring. Actually, people see crap movies all the time at the movies and you know it, don't you?
Yeah,
you absolutely know it. And this idea that the more screens that something is on and the more available and the more accessible it is gives it this mainstream stamp of approval and gives it a sense of popularity. That's what Australian films don't have. If you give a limited release, you're giving this very strong message. This is a niche title for a few people. And I think there is a very strong link between this idea of distribution and what we perceive to be popular in mainstream culture.
But I'd ask you, Lauren, in your paper, you're sort of talking really about a double bind, that on the one hand, the big international players are kind of squeezing out the room available for Australian screens at the cinema. But on the other hand, they're not opening up the possibility legally for Australian films to think about releasing simultaneously online so that people, instead of pirating, actually buy the films online and in cinemas.
Yeah, that's right. I think what a lot of people don't realise is that the Australian market is owned by the American distribution companies. They distribute, the six major distribution companies have almost 90% market share, and they have, you know, real solid agreements with the exhibition, with the multiplexes. They're pre-booked like 2 years in advance. They have absolutely no interest in taking on board 100 Bloody Acres or Patrick because, you know, their job is to feed the content of their parent companies, which are the major studios. So this is a system that is designed not for us. And that's why I think we have to move and we have to think outside the cinema because audiences already have. Only 1 in 10 are going to see first-run features at the cinema.
What would the effect be of releasing Australian films digitally? Does it just turn it into television?
Maybe, but that's not such a bad thing. TV is super popular at the moment, and I think there might be films, Australian films like 100 Bloody Acres and Patrick, that are really well suited to that laptop or home or even like big screen at home environment. You know, like I've got a massive television and I'm very happy to watch things at home, and they might find an audience better if they're not having to compete in that mad cinema market.
Well, we didn't even mention the word Netflix. Maybe that's a part two to this conversation we can have at a later date.
Yeah, certainly. I'm still a lover of watching a film on a big screen in a cinema as well. But the
pirates
have spoken.
And they have. The audience has spoken.
And if the industry does make it easier, I think, legally to download, I think everyone will be a winner.
Except the Kim.coms of the world.
Time now for obsessions. What's the bunny that you're boiling this week? Gary Maddox.
Well, I've discovered recently the joys of a little device called the Garmin. Now, I have the world's most sedentary job. If I'm not sitting at a desk typing a story, I'm sitting in the cinema watching a film or somewhere else watching a film. So I try and get out and run, ride a bike, do those sort of things. A little Garmin, it allows you to track when you're running, the pace you're running at, the heart rate, the distance you've covered. And it's actually not only an interesting way of training that helps you actually get fitter, but it's actually also a lot of fun working out how far you've gone, exactly putting it, downloading it, and then working out the route you've gone, working out your heart rate as you go up and down hills and those sorts of things. And I just find it a fascinating piece of machinery.
Well, for a Fairfax man, you've got a lot more in common with Rupert Murdoch than you might think. He told us in his Lowy Institute talk last week that he's doing the same thing.
Rupert and I often go running together and discuss our gadgets.
But also, you're not the first person in who's getting into this whole world of, you know, monitoring your own data. And
look, if you can't make yourself into a statistic, you don't exist anymore. Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Lauren Carroll Harris?
I've been really getting into this series, a UK series called Nathan Barley. And it's, the reason I got into it was because I started watching Black Mirror by Charlie Brooker, which is from last year and this year. An amazing, amazing series about our relationship with technology.
So the Black Mirror being the screen that you're reflected back by.
Yeah, exactly. And so I rifled through Charlie Brooker's back catalogue and found this series. And it's just quite remarkable. He predicts hipsters and he predicts phones that have apps, but he thought that the apps would be physical, like you kind of twist your phone one way and it'd become like an MP3 little like DJ device. And then
that's probably still to come.
Oh, okay. So we actually just haven't seen that yet. Yeah. But what the film is about, what the series is about is that hipster culture where it's an ironic mode of living. People who dress ironically, you know, wearing like leather vests and bicycle shorts to work and like hide behind their articulateness and those really smug intellectuals. So for someone like me, like, you know, mid-20s pop culture obsessive, who then wonders if I'm starting to speak in abbreviations like WTF, you know, like it really makes me question a lot of things. And it's amazing how he's predicted where popular culture will go in its obsession with irony and nostalgia.
All right, well, that sounds like a good one to look out for. What about you, Jason DeRosso?
Well, intermittently, I'm always interested in these new cameras coming out that have the bodies of old vintage cameras, and Nikon are just releasing one called the D4 that has this that looks like the original Nikon F from the late 1950s. And it just made me think everyone has a camera in their pocket now, and making, you know, images is completely unglamorous and un-niche. And I guess I was just trying to think why they do this, and really, besides just a retro exercise, I guess it's to make taking snaps kind of interesting and unique again or something.
I think Nathan Barley would approve.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, for my 10 cents worth, I'm quite obsessed with the idea of a four-part series about Paul Keating. I mean, he must really unload and there must be something really gritty.
Another thing about Barangaroo. And that Bob Hawke, don't get me started.
All right, well, we don't have 4 hours. We've got to go, unfortunately. So it's time to say thank you to our lovely guests this week, Gary Maddox and Lauren Carroll Harris. Thank you to the both of you.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Gary Maddox is a film writer with Fairfax, and Lauren Carroll Harris is a film scholar and author of the latest quarterly platform paper entitled Not at a Cinema Near You, Australia's Film Distribution Problem. And you can find that. It's published by Currency House. Well, it's time to go on the list. Remember to check out our webpage. If you're interested, we post all sorts of links relevant to the things we discuss each week.
Yes, and you might even want to leave us a comment. Time to go. I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Jason DeRosso. See you next week.